Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. Why do you think they're not looking at these people who have been
devastated? They don't see the urgency there. You know, the person that died already died. If you're looking at it from like that cold-hearted perspective, and people forget that grief can lead to a lot of things. You know, if we're not connecting people to support, and this is the way I see it, and I don't know if this is a little alarmist, it's we find ourselves asking, how did we get here with the opioid epidemic, which is now the everything crisis? And, you know, now there's all the documentaries explaining how the pharmaceutical companies got us here. I don't want us to, in a few decades or even a few years, see ourselves in a grief crisis and think, how did we get here? What did we miss? Why didn't we do anything? Like having documentaries be created about all the people that are grieving and how, you know, life just became so difficult for so many people. But I think that if we don't push for grief support, for people to start talking about this, if we don't take people out of the shadows and the isolation, those who are grieving, we could very well get there. Because 100,000 people each year dying means millions of new grievers each year. You know, everyone leaves behind at least a handful of people that are left to pick up the pieces when they die. So it's a big crisis, but it's a silent one right now. And so what can we do to make sure it's not silent, to make sure that we're pushing for some sort of supports for this crisis that goes hand in hand with the overdose crisis?
What is with the silence for the grief and traumatized individuals? Why is it silent?
Shame, because there's still so much stigma. Wow. People will still make people feel uncomfortable talking about it. But if we recognize this can happen to anyone, this doesn't change who your loved one was. This doesn't change who the family is. This could happen to anyone. There's a number of reasons, and we don't need to figure out exactly why it happened. We just need to respect people and treat them the way that we would treat any other griever for any other cause of death.
I'm remembering something. I think I've talked about it before, but when I, after Damien died, so I was 26, and I remember not wanting to tell anybody how he died. Like I immediately experienced shame, you know, and at that point, I didn't even realize what at that moment, like why, like if I'd known then what I know, you know, that kind of crap. And I remember a girl at work, a woman at work, coming up to me and saying, well, maybe if he had gotten into rehab earlier, and I'm thinking, maybe if I stab you in the neck with a fork, like, you know, that'll hurt a little bit less, you know. And if I had only known, I just remember looking at her like, are you fucking kidding me that you just said that? Like, by the way, he had been in and out 3 times. You know what I mean? Like, my brother had bipolar disorder and ADHD in a time where nobody knew how to even treat that. So it's more complicated than, oh, Damien had, you know, these disorders, and so we found a way to self-medicate. It was much more systematic than that and complicated. So that was one thing that popped in my mind. The second thing that popped into my mind when you were talking about the pharmaceutical companies was, and this is just another example from my personal life, is my mother and father live in Missouri. And my mom had like this, it was so disgusting. It was so disgusting. It looked so, and my mother's very hard-headed, but anyway, she got bit by a spider, and this spider must have been really pissed off because it left these boils on the outside of her skin. Oh, it was bad. I couldn't even believe it. I thought she was exaggerating on the phone.
Missouri?
So I had no idea. It looked like it might have been a brown recluse. I don't know. It might not be right. I don't even know if they are in that part of the United States, but they refused to give her painkillers. Mm-hmm. And her primary refused to follow up to give her painkillers. And it was like, oh, well, you can try ibuprofen. Are you kidding me? Like, I've had boils lanced off my leg. So now we've got doctors, and tell me if I'm wrong, but have been getting in trouble for prescribing. And so now they've gone overboard, and people who do need pain management, then now they're not stepping up and taking care of them. Is that something that just happened to my mom, or is that happening in other places?
That's happening to a ton of people, not only not starting them, but suddenly stopping them. So if they were giving pain medications and the doctor all of a sudden thinks there's a concern and they just stop someone, we know how addicting these things are. People are going to need to take care of themselves, but we will see that a lot. And that's the issue again with those counterfeit pills. So if somebody can't get it from their doctor, they might go and get it from the street, from a friend, from somebody, and it could very well not be what they thought it was. And even the dealer might not know that it's not, you know, there's a lot of people and a lot of this focus is on prosecuting the dealers and, you know, getting them arrested. But a lot of times there's such a long chain from when a drug is manufactured to when it gets to the person on the street that the last couple of people in that chain might really think that it, you know, could be a pain medication that they're selling. So, but when we have all this fear, you know, our society, it's so litigious. And so when we have this fear of lawsuits and responsibility, that's when we see, you know, the doctors not even wanting to handle anything that has to do with pain and people just overall kind of living in fear about it. When these medications, when prescribed properly, when monitored, when people are explained the risks, when they're given all the information, for some people, they really do need them. And so it's striking that balance, but we have a tendency to be on one end of the spectrum or on other end of the spectrum, you know, just really like swinging that pendulum.
Yeah, I've definitely saw that. I got my knee replaced, right, in 2019. They ripped my leg open. They used hammers and chisels and all the things. They zipped me back up with a thing that actually looked like a zipper. And had they not put this like numbing agent thing in there that was like this little bubble I had to carry around a little bit. And it went directly into my leg and it numbed that part of my leg, right? And I was like, I didn't even know they had that. That's awesome. I don't have to take a painkiller because I didn't want to do that. But you're only allowed to do that for a couple days. So when they took it out, I was like, oh my freaking God. This is the worst pain I've ever felt in my life, right? So they had given me painkillers. I didn't want to take them, but I also like nothing I was doing was alleviating enough of the pain. So I did end up taking them for like 2 days, but they made me feel so poisoned and my body wasn't responding very well to it at all. Like I had to make a choice. And at that point, I chose to like just suck it up, which I'm not real good at just sucking things up. I'm not a fan, but I will if I can't function. So, you know, but they were so hesitant. They're like, well, we can give you 3 pills. I'm just like, what is the point of that? But they were like, they don't want to lose their licenses because they're being tracked so cautiously now. So then it's, you know, they're coming down on them. But what are they doing to change in our society? What are they doing to change what's going on with fentanyl and opioids and all these things that are happening? Is there any improvement at all in trying to stop this?
It is, and it's community by community. You know, some are taking a really aggressive approach, pushing for safe injection sites or safe consumption sites. Then you have others that are really just trying to arrest anyone that has anything to do with this crisis. So it really, the response varies, but I think that this is the one thing that unites us is no community has been spared by this. Now, how we react to it, you know, how we respond to it, how communities try to do something about it, then that can be really divisive because everyone's doing something different. But I think everyone agrees we're in a terrible crisis. We're losing people of all ages, genders, socioeconomic demographics, you know, everyone is dying from this. So everyone can kind of agree this is an issue. We need to do something about it. It's just a matter of agreeing on what it is that we have to do about it. And some approaches are more scientifically informed than others. Some are more morally informed than others. And it's striking that balance of, you know, finding what works best for a community to keep people alive, even if it makes some people a little uncomfortable. But that's where that education piece comes into it.
Is there any kind of pattern as to which kind of communities seem to be taking an approach that is actually effective versus ones that are like just coming down with, you know, a hammer and just being like, nope, we're just gonna, you know, try to hammer this out and it doesn't work? I mean, is there any pattern at all?
Well, there is. It just depends how controversial we want to get on here. Well, we know that.
Well, it's my podcast. We can get as controversial as we want. Go for it.
So the research behind the safe consumption sites show, you know, there's a place in Canada that everyone in the US that has tried starting one is modeling it off of. So Philadelphia tried starting one that got shut down by the community, but New York started too, modeling it off a safe consumption site in Canada. And really what that means for those who aren't familiar is it's a safe place to go consume drugs. And for a lot of people, that's the craziest thing they have ever heard, because it feels like it's condoning substance use. These places do not provide the drugs. They just provide safe tools for doing so. So, you know, clean needles so that people aren't sharing needles, clean pipes, what have you. And they have professionals on all levels there to respond to the person as needed. So they'll have social workers there if the person is interested in learning about rehabs, learning about different services, but it is never pushed. It's not like a condition of coming in. And then they'll have medical professionals that can respond and reverse an overdose immediately. And the place in Canada hasn't had a single death. The place in New York, from what I've heard, has been open about 2 years. Same, not a single death.
Stop it.
People freak out about these places, and it goes to that NIMBY, not in my backyard. Well, we don't want this here. You know, we don't want drugs in the community. Drugs are in the community. You know, it's just a matter of, are people doing it inside their private homes? Are they doing it on the street if you're in downtown areas? And so that is one that has been proven over and over again, but it gets challenged every time it eyes popping up in any community because people are so afraid of it. It's that lack of education, that, you know, moral discomfort with something so different. But we know that nothing else was working. You know, we got to this point. We tried everything before we got to this. This wasn't the first idea. You know, this wasn't the second or third idea. We tried the Just Say No. We tried all these different things. And so it's kind of got us here where scientifically it makes sense, but morally for a lot of people, it just doesn't sit right.
Is there any evidence or data about whether or not it keeps people addicted longer versus getting help where they might have gotten help had they not been, what I'm hearing you say, quote unquote, enabled to continue to use?
Yeah. So I couldn't tell you the exact numbers. I'm sure there is research on it, but qualitatively, kind of anecdotally, it has been said that, yes, once people have relationships and don't feel judged, don't feel this pressure of, I need to go to treatment because, you know, that's my agreement, otherwise I'll get arrested again. You know, when we have that, it doesn't work so well. In these places where we have, you know, and even if it's not a safe consumption site, even if it's like a needle exchange program or some sort of social services, people anecdotally, when they feel seen, heard, validated, and not judged or pressured, will go to these places when they are ready. But we can't rush anyone to be ready. And, you know, I'm not sure of the exact data of if we're extending the time for them to be ready or not. We know that peer support is crucial in these spaces, being able to see somebody else who has gotten to a place of recovery. That is tremendously helpful. I do know that there's research there that in any setting, in hospitals, when they add peer recovery specialists, it increases people going into recovery because it's one-to-one. They see themselves, they see that hope versus a doctor in a white coat saying, you should do this, but this doctor has never struggled with substance use. So that's kind of where I know that the data is, but that's a really good question and one definitely worth looking into.
You find out, let me know. I'm kind of curious. You know, the first time, I think the only time I ever saw, and I didn't understand what it was at the time, one of these, the sites that you're talking about, I was in Amsterdam. They had one in Amsterdam. And I remember the person who I was with, she knew what it was. And she goes, yeah, that's a place where people can go. And I'm like, what? And the city just like says like, this is cool. Like that, you know? And she's like, yeah, it ends up being a safe. And after I realized what it was, I was kind of like, well, that kind of makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, and then I was like, well, we don't got that going on in the United States, you know, at all, you know? And there was something else that you said, which was, you know, that peer support. And I think about in mental health, how frequent it is for drug and alcohol counselors to be people who used to use, And there's something about that normalization and that hope that you were just talking about. That's kind of like, hey, if I can get to a point where I am now helping other people, I am so not judging you because I have walked, I've walked a path. I'm not saying I know exactly what you're going through, but I've definitely walked a path. I've lost people to, drug overdose too, or alcohol overdose, or whatever. I've watched families, get annihilated over all of this. So I think there's a strength there. For people who are drug and alcohol counselors, who have been able to find their way, for perhaps they were previous, users and they're in recovery. So I think that's kind of interesting because you hear people say, well, just go to AA or go to NA. But every single AA or NA group has a different culture, number one. Number two, I have heard, I don't know, tell me if I'm crazy here, but I have heard, and in some cases, the culture in that NA group or whatever actually ends up being a place where people are getting drugs. Like it's an exchange that ends up happening there when it was obviously clearly never intended for that. Did I, because I had somebody tell me that a person I was working with, is that something that you've seen or heard about?
I've heard it anecdotally, wouldn't say too often, don't know too much about it, but it is, comments people will say here and there.
Kind of curious about that. I'm not saying I think that whatever peer support we can grab in the community, we should do it, and keep going until you find a pro, a group that you feel like you fit into. Like, okay, if that's not the culture you fit into, because like there are certain ones that like are all men, right? For example, in AA, there might be an all women's group or an all men's group, or even some groups that are like for professionals. Like, there's it's kind of specific in that way. Is that right?
I think it's right, and I think it's important to talk about because we're always, we're always pushing towards having difference of opinion, having different thoughts, different people represented. But the one place where actually similarities are the most powerful is in that peer support space, being able to see yourself in somebody else. So it is really important to have specific groups. In Philly, when we had support groups, we ended up, we started out just open support groups, anyone can come, and people would form little groups within the group of their own peers, so the moms would kind of all talk about what it's like to be a mom that has lost a child, and then siblings and the significant others, to the point where we're like, all right, we need to start all these different groups so that people feel as safe to speak, which is different than our normal approach of let's just throw everyone in there and that's where we're going to get like the richest discussion, which is great. I believe in that for everything. But when it's that peer support, you want people to be as similar as possible so they can see themselves in the other person and bond over that shared experience.
I love that. Do you think that that's why like Al-Anon is something that's important as well? And for those viewers and listeners, Al-Anon is for like family members and friends of people who are addicted to alcohol. But I have seen a lot of people go in there because of, is there Nar-Anon?
There's Naranon, there's Al-Anon, yeah.
And has that been proven to be an effective or helpful organization for people who have loved ones who are struggling with addiction?
I don't know much in terms of the organization, what, if it's been successful or not, but I will say that generally speaking, smaller, more specific groups are more effective for people because there's more connection there, there's deeper connection. So if we kind of specify it, so if we have the families in one group and the friends in another group and what have you, that is definitely more successful. People feel safer speaking. When we have those general groups that I mentioned, significant others, somebody whose partner had died would say that they didn't feel comfortable speaking about their grief because they didn't want to take away time and space from the mom whose child had died. And so people were disenfranchising their own grief when everybody is entitled to their grief journey. How do we make them feel as safe as possible? Well, let's give them a group of their peers that they're all on the same level. And at a higher level, it's the same thing with substance use. A lot of individuals want support groups that are specific to grief following a death due to substance use because, boom, everyone is on the same level. There's no risk of somebody carrying stigma and saying some terrible, hurtful things. So, keeping all of that in mind when we think about the groups that we recommend people go to.
Yep, the homogenous groups. We talk about that, because we have like a bereaved parent group, And our groups are just really starting to get up and really, you know, running at the Center for Grief and Trauma Therapy. And the bereaved parents, I remember when I was co-leading that, there was one mother whose son died from, I don't want to give out too much information because, you know, obviously confidentiality, but from a drug overdose, from an opioid overdose. And I kind of felt like she felt a little different than like the family who lost their child to, you know, a car accident, for example. Not, I didn't have anybody in there, but, you know, had that been. So I think you're right. I think when you find people who they're able to relate to, it provides them an opportunity to almost take a deep breath and go, okay, now I can finally let down. I can put the light of empathy on my shame. And, you know, Brené Brown talks about how you can't have shame under the light of empathy. And I think there's a lot to be, you know, said about that. So how I could ask you a billion questions, and I'm sure you have like things to do today, but how is there a difference in the grief and trauma of a survivor of a death from overdose that you see in comparison to what you imagine somebody who has had a loss to a different kind of a death?
Yes. Not for every single person, but for a lot of people, there is that questioning that you mentioned that if this, you know, if I had done the coulda, shoulda, woulda, there's a lot of shame, regret, guilt. And the most harmful one, those are all really difficult, but I think it's the isolation. People just kind of holding themselves up because nobody else is going to understand, because nobody else is going to respect their loved one. Because if they find out that this happened, they're going to think he was a failure, when that's not true at all. And so how can we allow people the space to share their grief the way they would if it was any other reason that the person died? And so making really safe, supportive communities that welcome these individuals, that don't perpetuate the shame and stigma, is crucial, because that's the biggest thing that I see there versus somebody where the death was something completely different, like you mentioned.
What do you think would be needed for a survivor in order to begin to integrate this loss, even with the shame that they're experiencing? You know, even if they, like, if they don't have a grief, this is just their own natural process, right? Because 85 to 90% of people go through an uncomplicated grieving process. And certainly a death from an overdose is a risk factor for more of a complicated grieving process, right? With the disenfranchisement, it being unexpected, usually untimely, so many different risk factors, right? So what would be helpful for them to know? Like, if they're listening, you've got a survivor right now who's listening, what do they need?
You're not alone. And what you know now, you didn't know then. And so recognizing that hindsight is 20/20, so often for these sudden unexpected deaths, whether it's substance use, whether it's suicide, whatever it may be, people have a lot more information after the death than they did while the person was alive. And so recognizing you did not know that back then, take yourself back to that point and know that you did the best you could with the information that you had, with the knowledge that you had, with the education. And so what I would say these individuals need is a lot of time and space to process to these questions, not immediately shutting people down when they go through the coulda, woulda, shoulda, because that's a normal, natural part of the experience, being there with people, allowing them to ask those questions, but also reminding them, you know, that we didn't know then what we know now. If you knew this person was going to die, I'm sure you would have given everything up in your life to be there with them for the last 6 months or so. So I think that's important. And also knowing that you're not alone and that this doesn't change who that person was. All your memories are still valid. A lot of what we see, especially for the really sudden, really unexpected ones, where maybe the family didn't know anything about substance use, you know, maybe the more recreational users, could be someone where it was truly their first time, you know, it can happen. And so for those people, it's, well, maybe I didn't even know this person after all. And then like erasing the legacy that they have of this person. So knowing that, no, what you knew, your experiences with them, those are true and those are valid. And it is both and, not either or. You know, you could have had all of those moments and all of that richness to the relationship. And there could have also been a side of them that you didn't know. And both can exist. It doesn't take away what you knew you had and what you had in the moment.
I don't think you could have said that any better. I love that. I love that from a personal perspective. It just makes sense to me socially. And so now you're going to want to kill me because I'm going to throw a wrench in that.
I'm going to throw a wrench in it.
What if I knew you were somebody I did not care for? Maybe you were somebody that abused me. I knew you were using. I didn't even care if you died. Matter of fact, I hope maybe you would overdose. I mean, icky. Like, I'm just putting it out there because there is ickiness that is the reality of life. And so when they die, and I know for sometimes people feel relief and then feel guilt for the relief, but some people just feel relief. Like, fine, I don't have to deal with this shit anymore. Or I feel like he had it coming because he hurt so many people. And I don't like saying that, by the way, at all. But this is just the reality that there might be some people who are watching or listening and they're going, I did not give a shit whether or not he died or not, you know, and maybe I don't feel good about the way that I felt about that. But, you know, everything else that you had just said, which I got to be honest with you, I agree with you 1,000%. What do we do there? Aren't you just glad that you came on this? So I could just have a hard time about everything.
No, I love it. You know, when I've reached out to over 3,000 people by my time doing outreach in Philly, you know, I heard every end of the spectrum. And so I would get comments like that. And, you know, I got everything. It was just so many people and so many people are affected by this that you know, that could be a whole nother episode. The wildest things I heard in response to asking people how they're doing. This person died. But what I would say is, you're entitled to your emotions. If you got there, there was a reason you got there. And we don't need to put people on a pedestal just because they died. And if those are your emotions, don't feel guilt for them. You know, what I always tell people, and it's normally more in the grief experience, but it could apply to this situation, is we can't change what happened. The only thing that we can change is how we treat ourselves, how we react to ourselves. And so in a case like this, if that's how you're feeling and that's how you're comfortably going through the world and you're not the one that killed them or, you know, caused any of this, so be it. That's okay. There's a lot of pressure to say that this was the best person ever and they will be so missed. And, you know, that's what we're so used to telling people. So those who don't feel that way, there's also a stigma and a shame there. And so telling them the exact same thing we would tell the people that are feeling shame for another reason, it's okay.
Perfect. Just perfect. I think that is ultimately what I'm hearing you say is that let's get the shame out of this. And there's lots of other kinds of ways that people die where there is shame, you know, like suicide and homicide and AIDS and, you know, DUIs and all the other things. And really there's a lot of talk around, we've got to pull the shame out of these things so that people can talk and people can heal and learn how to integrate this loss. But if we don't come together as a community, and we're in a very individualized society and very individualistic as compared to maybe some other cultures that are a lot more collective. And I'd be so curious about those cultures. Like, what do they do it differently? Do they handle this stuff differently? I don't know.
Well, you're about to start us off on another hour because that's my that's my simultaneous passion. So I'm Latina, and it was something that I explored a lot early on in my career because I thought I was going to come in and start these Spanish speaking support groups and, you know, serve the community and do all these things. I was so excited. Learned very quickly that was not going to work. And so kind of exploring why that happened, and it's recognizing, even though it was my community and I was raised fully in Spanish and everything, but I grew up and my education and my work experience was in white English spaces where there was this push for support groups and talk about your feelings and stuff. I had to go back and realize, no, that's not, you know, where my initial community or my home community is, you know, with the Latino community. And again, this can be a full other podcast episode. It's a very faith-based community. So a lot of different communities, and I can speak to that one, are more so keep it at home, keep it in your relationship with God, pray through it, pray and you will get better. God's going to take care of you. God doesn't give you things that you can't handle, you know, all of these things that are said. And so that's how a lot of communities cope. And so again, it comes back to accepting people where they are, meeting them where they are, if that's how they want to cope. And that's something I had to let go of, because I came in with a little bit of a savior complex of thinking, you know, I'm here, I'm going to do this. And it was very, very fascinating to kind of go through that, like unlearning and relearning of my own culture that I thought I knew. So, you know, that's taking us on a whole nother tangent.
Well, would you be willing to come back for another conversation around that? Because I mean, we're such a multicultural, you know, country, and it's only becoming more multicultural. So it'd be really stupid for us not to talk about it on that level. So can I drag you through this for another hour at another time?
Absolutely. I think it's something that's really important. It's really important because a lot of times people have really good intentions, and that's, you know, coming in and let's start these support groups for this community and let's do this and let's do that. And it's no. It has to be community informed. We can't just come in and say, this is the right way to grieve. This is the right way to provide grief support. It's a matter of seeing, okay, what is working here? What have people traditionally done? What can we help with and support with? So yes, let's definitely explore that.
Super stoked about that. All right. So as we're kind of winding down today, this was fascinating to me. And you're so, oh my God, you've got such a finger on the pulse of what's going on. And I couldn't have been luckier than to have you on this episode. But what are three things you want our viewers to take away?
Number one, you're not alone. There's so many people going through this. Number two, whatever you're feeling right now, it's okay, whatever that might be. And number three, it's not always going to be as heavy and as overwhelming as it is. We do grow around our grief. We do adjust to it. We don't overcome it. There's no curing it. There's no certificate that you're done grieving, but we get much stronger, and it allows us to view the world in a new way, to build new relationships. There's a lot of beauty that can come from this incredibly difficult experience. So taking it day by day and not rushing anything, not judging ourselves for not being as strong as we would want at whatever point we think that has to be. It's not linear, and there's no timeline for it.
Oh, that's such an important thing to make sure that people hear over and over again. So again, thank you so much for coming. And to my audience, if this was something that you have found valuable and you've liked this, you know, click on like and subscribe. Give us your comments below. I'd love to see your comments on this one. I will collect those comments and make sure that I respond to them. And I'm glad that you came. And again, I'm so thankful that you were here. I'm thoughtful too, but thankful that you came. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.